Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to the official Project Blue Book podcast. I'm your host, Tara Bennett, a senior producer for Sci-Fi Wire. So picking up where we left off last week, the Roswell incident part two. We continue.
Dun, dun, dun.
And we play out the story of that now infamous event. So the man that landed this episode is showrunner and executive producer Sean Jablonsky. Hello, sir.
Hello. I like the landed part.
There you go. And with him today, together in one room, are the generals. I'm so happy to welcome back Michael Harney, who plays General Valentine.
Hello.
And General Harding, Neil McDonough, hello.
Howdy, how are you?
Oh, no phone calls. It's all bodies
it's all
in the
live.
Same space.
No, I
love it. It's beautiful. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Sean, let's start with the fact that this is officially the show's very first two-parter. Let's talk about choosing the split, where you guys are going to put that cliffhanger, because we end episode one with the ship that looks like it's right in the middle of the town. We pick up right where that left off. Was it an easy split? Did you guys labor over that?
So this is a great story. So it wasn't a two-parter when we started.
Oh.
There is a version that is a one-episode Roswell episode. And after reading the first draft, I was like, there's just too much story. It just felt like we were trying to cram way too much in. The script was already long, and I was like, we need to let it breathe a little more. And there's still more ideas and characters and scenes we wanted to put in that we pulled out just for that. And so, okay, we got to split this in half. So in terms of how we did it, I think it was almost clear. I think end of Act 4 originally was the saucer, and then all of the stuff in the TV studio happened just in Act 5. And I was like, this is going to be insane if we got to squeeze this all
out. Totally.
So once we realized we could divide it up, it's like, oh, that scene we cut before, we can put that in, and we moved it around. And so it wasn't a organic process. The story told us what it needed to be.
It feels in some ways like it's constructed a bit like a murder mystery. You've got this clue hunt. You've got a lot of elements of characters racing to move towards this kind of long con that we're getting from Booker.
Yes. The trick from the beginning was, how do we make Roswell feel urgent?
Yeah.
Because technically Blue Book never investigated it. It's 6 years past. It was a cold case, essentially. We'd never really done a cold case before. But the history and the characters of what happened at the time, there's so much left hanging about Roswell and how many people were affected by it. We're like, what if someone just never got over it? You know, and for us, the impetus from the beginning was always, we call it the Harding origin story, because that was the reason Roswell was such a cover-up, was because of who Harding's character is based on. General Twining came down and basically shut it down. And I encourage anybody who's listening who has any curiosity to read a little bit about it and the extent of the intimidation and the cover-up and the stories that changed as soon as Harding got to town. It's just undeniable. I tell this story that there's a great book called Witness to Roswell that all of us read in preparation for the episode, but I gave it to my dad, who is a middle America sort of skeptical kind of guy. I said, Dad, you should read this book. I think you'd find it fascinating. He was in the Air Force as well. And he read it. He called me about 2 weeks later and he goes, they're real.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, literally, he was like, there's no doubt in my mind.
Wow.
He was staggered by the information and the cover-up that was so apparent. And the book is really well written and researched, so.
Well, let me ask the two of you then, you know, because we have talked in season one about your thoughts about all of this and, you know, how the show has changed or augmented what you've already thought about things. But Roswell, how much of that was a case that was very present, because you guys both play a big piece in both of these two episodes. And so did you feel like you wanted to bone up a little bit, read anything? Was there anything that you wanted in your prep so that you kind of understood the case a little bit more, so this interpretation of it was present in your head?
When you're given really great words as an actor, it's pretty awesome. So to delve into the psyche of Harding,
Twining is something that I was really looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
And they allowed me to do that. So for me, it's not so much about reading books about this and that. For me, as an actor, I'm really about the character
mm-hmm.
and what words are given to me and how I can make those entertaining for the audience. That's what I do. I'm not so much of a big researcher as to the history of lots of things when it pertains to acting, because a lot of this is based on fact.
Right.
And for Harding, I'm not really Twining,
mm-hmm.
so I'm not 100% basing everything on facts. It's, as an actor, what can I dredge up out of me to make things really emotional and raw and fun to watch for the audience? When I read the first couple episodes of the season, I was just so pleased that I got to do so much great stuff. And by doing so, it allowed for a fantastic relationship. Like last year, Valentine and myself, we kind of barked orders and got angry at people in the big office or the big room or this or that. And stay on the course, do your job, don't you? This year, it's different. This year, we go back to a time where I don't want to talk about it anymore. And the only person who gets me through it is Valentine. And to be able to work with this guy and have the words from Sean on history, it's just been a fantastic ride thus far.
Michael, did you end up looking at it a little differently?
YouTube is my favorite.
A good thing, too, yes.
And I watched a lot of interviews mm-hmm. with high-ranking guys in the Air Force who had very high-level clearance who had come out and mm-hmm. talked about this event. And then I had to kind of discern which ones I was buying and which ones I didn't buy, you know. But for me, a lot of it had to do with behavior. And what I mean by that is that it's one thing to be able to assess a situation and be able to embrace the entire playing field.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's another thing to, while doing that, make a conscious decision to go one way and really stand behind that. In this case, would be to control the environment and knowing that Neil would be able to do that full force and living with that. I found that to be very challenging as an interior life for myself. So I wound up landing there in a lot of ways. And then just really kind of tripping out on these beings, you know, and this whole thing about engagement. And then I started daydreaming and going into daydreams about being with them and saying, well, I must have some contact somehow, or, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Jeez, I thought I went deep in the writing process. You're communicating with them.
That's right.
It's just the result of my previous research.
Yeah, and being able to play in that playing field, which is so great.
Yeah.
Well, the dynamic between the two of you is interesting because in season one, like you said, there was a lot of the two of them feeling like they're relatively of a unit, maybe a little bit more of Harding being a little more aggressive than Valentine. But this time, we're kind of looking at a potential blip in Harding's career. What was interesting for you and David O'Leary to just basically think, how can we shake them up a little bit and change their dynamic this year?
Shake up, I look at more as like utilize what they have, because we've talked about this and I raised my hand and I said, guys, you're so much better than we gave you, I think, in season one in terms of what is available, not just as actors, but as characters. And, you know, look, in any season, especially a first season, you're finding the show, you're
exactly.
trying to figure out what elements work. And I think we made it a mission of ours, David and I, in the writer's room. We said, look, we have these two brilliant actors and characters. They can't be reduced to the finger-wagging generals all the time. And that's where we wanted to dig in and get a little personal and then explore the dynamic individually and how they are together now. And that was, for us, honestly, digging a little deeper for Harding's character and understanding what makes him tick. And that's why the origin of what happened in Roswell, if that was his first introduction to the UFO phenomenon and experience and what he had to do, he carries that everywhere. And that,
yeah.
for us, helped explain a lot of what happened in season one. And for Valentine to understand the weight of the intelligence and the information that he is privy to
mm-hmm.
and what that means outside of the environment that he's in, it made us always think, oh, he's always carrying around not only a second agenda, but a different understanding of what's happening.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh, wow, he's actually turning the wheels in a way that we can work with a lot more. And that kind of opened it up for us. And so thank you guys for being open to that as well. And again, you know, season one, we were finding it. Season two, I think we hit our stride.
Thanks,
a little bit.
Man. It's so cool because, you know, Sean has an open door and we talked about these things,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's so great when you work with somebody and it's just open. You're open and all of a sudden it's better. You're working off each other. You know, I did a movie one time. It was just me in a car with my daughter in the back
mm-hmm.
and I'm driving down down the highway, you know, and I'm a little bit sketchy, you know. And I said, no, man, I'm off my meds. I got PTSD. I saw too much time in war and went by the school and I took my daughter. He said, that's great. It's better than what I wrote. Let's go with it. And we went with it.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
And that's what's going on the show, which is really kind of a rarity when it comes to this genre.
Let's talk a little bit about seeing Harding in action in this episode as well, because we see him waterboarding Booker, the huge reveal on camera. There's just a lot of elements of really kind of watching you as a military person and then also watching what gets to you.
Because of what happened, especially in the studio, mm-hmm. which we'll get back to the heart attack in a second.
Yeah.
That one, which is pretty funny. When it came to the waterboarding with Booker, you could see that Harding wasn't enjoying any of this. But as a soldier, he had to get the information. This is the way he was taught how to get information. Well, this is really important, high-level stuff. So the only way that he knew how he would definitely get the answers was by doing this. A lot of it hinged upon going back to that scene where I was in the studio. And it was a great moment between Hynek and myself because I'm telling the world that this is all just a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm duped. And they set up this whole situation where they're going to show the aliens from 1947 and what I did to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought to myself, what would I do if I were one of the most decorated Air Force men of all time? And to see my life in seconds crumble. I will no longer have a job. My kids are going to think I'm just a butcher. My wife will probably leave me. I'll mm-hmm. certainly never be in a military outfit again, which I've done for the last 35 years. What would I do in this situation? And I just started thinking, okay, well, I'd probably start having a heart attack. When I was doing the scene, we kept doing it over and over and over again with different angles as we do it in the show. And I could feel myself, my breathing went so odd, and I could feel my heart just really kind of skipping in a different way. And the sweat, you know, it was cold inside the studio, as I remember, but the sweat just started beating on me and all over, like my arms and my head and everything. I could feel myself getting white.
Yeah.
And the director called cut, and he walked up to me and goes, Neil, are you okay? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, he looks like you're having a heart attack. Do I need to call a medic? I'm like, I'm acting. And then he went back, okay, roll cameras, keep going. But that's because when you get to delve into a character and really, again, when it comes to history or this or books, I like to get into the psyche of a character. And I think that's what I'm really good at. God gave me a great talent of being a really good actor because, and I've said a million times, just because I'm a great actor doesn't make me a great person. I have to work hard at being a great human being. But he gave me this gift, and he gave Michael the gift in Buckets. So to be there on that stage and find the absolute truth of the character was one of my favorite things I've done ever on screen, you know, because it was so subtle. You may not even see it as the audience. That's why I generally never watch a lot of my stuff, because on the day, it's so enjoyable to go through such trauma at times and dredge up the what ifs of life. And for me, that day, that moment was my second favorite moment in the show. That's pretty awesome.
That's awesome.
First of all, thank you. To your point, you sit in the edit room, you see these moments probably 50, 60 times. And there's this moment when Harding stands up and his hand is shaking and he puts it over his mouth. And it's like, I've seen it so often and it always strikes me as being so authentic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can always sort of read on the heads and tails of takes and stuff like that. But I felt like you couldn't have stopped your hand shaking if you wanted to.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize my hand was shaking.
Yeah, it was, you literally do this.
There's another moment in the episode that I really love too, is before that when Hynek and Harding go at it, talking about the Enola Gay, throwing verbal punches at you with that. It was a great moment just because of the way that you both played it. Two very strong points of view that room. You played it in a way that looked like he cracked you a little bit and that, how dare you? But then also feeling the weight of that kind of call. Tell me a little bit about playing against Aiden in that scene.
Well, going back to the scene in the studio, who's the person who really saved my life? It was Hynek.
Hynek, yep.
Really? This guy that gets under my skin so much is the one who went to bat for me?
Mm-hmm.
So when the two of us are in my office and talking about the Enola Gay, talking about what has to be done, here's my agenda, here's your agenda, and it's two bulls going at it. Aiden Gillen's, you know, he's a champion. Look how blessed we are, the guys and girls that I get to work with on this show. It's fantastic. And then we get great words, and then we get the amazing sets. The sets on the show, I mean, come on.
That's awesome.
And the wardrobe, and the cars, and the fedoras, and the uniforms. And this year I get to roll up my sleeves instead of just wearing a jacket all the time. You see, General Harding wants to get down and dirty and take care of stuff this year. And it was just a whole different season. But that scene with Aiden was, the moment in the studio was a great moment, but the moment where the two of us are going at it with each other, with respect for each other, was really just dynamite television. Oh, by the way, going back to Booker, we had a stuntman because waterboarding, you know, after 30 seconds of waterboarding, you can get choked out and bad things can happen. Waterboarding's not easy. It's absolute torture. So on the day, we had the stuntman there, and he's actually, no, I got this. I'm like, dude, do you know what happens when you can't breathe and you're suffocating, you have water being poured in your face? He goes, no, I don't, but I'm going to do it. I'm like, all right, and we did it, and we did it for 30, 40-second takes over and over, and he was like, let's do it again. I'm like, wow.
He is a
different breed of man. And yeah, so, like, he literally runs, like, 10 miles a day.
Wow.
Rain or shine.
Literally every day.
Doesn't matter
what
happened the night before. And his brother, I don't know if you know this, but his brother, I think, is a Marine or a Navy SEAL or something like that, and wanted to test it out at one point. It sounds like that family has some pretty strong genes over there.
Party genes,
so
yes.
I was like, try it out. Let's see it. So he's coming, you know, wanted to see what that felt like. So anyway, good on you.
He wasn't letting his family down.
No.
Good I on may not have been in the armed services, but I'm as tough as you.
He proved
it that day. Yeah. Man.
In going back into the crafting, what Booker needs them to kind of pull the string on and get them to that studio, when I was talking about the mystery of it all and kind of unfolding and playing the steps.
Well, it's funny because even when I watched it, I was like, wow, it worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I think even sometimes you write it and you look at it and you're like, God, there's so much that has to go right for this to work. But as an approach, we knew it pretty early on, and I was like, this is Seven.
Yeah.
This is Kevin Spacey going, I'm showing up in the police station, going, you got me. That's why Hynek has that line, is like, whatever he's doing, he's not done.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's where that all came from. When you have something like that to lean on a little bit, I was like, okay, if we kind of follow those marks, we can kind of do it. And we knew that, look, we had the film. We had Harding's moment of sort of comeuppance or revelation, reveal, whatever you want to call it. And we had to get there. And it was like, what do you want to do? You want to put Harding and Booker on the same stage for that moment.
Yes.
And so it was like everything just, we funneled it right there. But Seven was the inspiration.
So in terms of mythology, because, you know, you've got lots of people that know Roswell. You've got some people that are more mainstream that don't know it as well. So you're servicing two sides of it. But you're also bringing in a lot of elements. People that had lived there that are now questioning. You've also got the alien autopsy, which is its own kind of thing.
Which you can find on YouTube.
Which is huge in UFO lore. And you are kind of making this melange of things that work out together. And was there anything that you paired out of that? Because it all helps to set the stage and give a lot of elements to the story for this season, but it is a mixture of mythologies that don't necessarily have connection to each other, but you made it work for the show.
Yeah, there was so much to work with, which is, again, why I think we had to do it in two parts. I think we squeezed almost all of the things we wanted to, but they were rounding people up and bringing them into gymnasiums and sort of almost like a mass prison or something like that to question and make sure people weren't getting the story out. People were hiding all of these pieces of debris in their homes, and they were being home-by-home searches and being threatened. There's a great BBC documentary about Roswell where they go back and they talk to a lot of people who were there. Again, if anybody would love a real good primer on it, watch that, because you see the pain on these people's faces who are like, people threatened to kill me if I said anything. A little girl at the time, she was like 6 or 7, said the army men, she was older now, obviously, but I'm getting goosebumps talking about this. She said, I remember they came in and they said, my bones would bleach in the desert.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so my whole thing with the phenomenon in general, for people who, anybody who's skeptical about it, I always go, well, what do you have to believe that none of this is true?
Right.
So what do you believe then? You must believe this girl has carried this story for 50 years, that this actually happened and she made it all up.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Same thing with anybody who has seen or experienced something that's profoundly affected them. If you don't want to believe in the phenomenon at all, you have to go, what I believe is that everybody's lying, saw something that didn't exist.
Amazing actors.
Embellished it. And at great, great expense to not only their character, but their reputation, their own peace of mind. People hang on to these stories for life. So you want to believe that this is what people do just for what attention? Because most people shy away from it. Most people don't want to talk about it. A lot of people who have had the experience keep it to themselves. Or in the case of Roswell, when people go back to talk to them, they're like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. So it's not for seeking attention.
They don't want to speak about it.
They don't want
says
to speak about
so
it.
Yeah. Much that there's does. Something happened.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You see a lot of guys from war. They don't want to speak about war because they don't want to go back to
it. Experiences are too hard.
Exactly.
Too hard to read.
And it's behind them now. So
a lot of the families in the Air Force, you know, the wives of men who have passed on, they talk about that their husbands took these stories to their graves.
Yeah. And, an emotional lockbox.
But they told their wives. I just have to mention the honor aspect of the mm-hmm. whole thing and about yes. maintaining a strong degree of honor in terms of following orders
yes.
to get a common goal done. And there's a lot to be said about that.
That's a really good point.
Well, when you were crafting all of this, you basically had to recreate the alien autopsy.
Yes.
So
fun.
Let's talk about that part, because then it leads back to the ending of the episode. What did you guys want to reproduce for us to see, as well as other characters in the show to see?
We had a couple of agendas we had to get. One was that we knew Hynek had to see the film and deduce from it that it was a fake. So we had to lay in this light pattern in the ceiling. I think there's a clock on the wall, some tile in the room as well. So we knew that had to be a part of it. I still have a little bit of story muscle memory from Nip/Tuck, where we worked with a lot of prosthetics. And almost every episode, there was some sort of person or body part on a table
yes.
that was prosthetic
yeah.
that had to be operated on. So I felt like I had a little insight there. And I was like, I really want this to be disturbing. I said, we can't go half measures here. Yes, the original version is a little bad.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they would have had in 53 would never have looked as good as we made it look.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're making a good TV show. And so the director, Darren, and I, we spoke, and I said, whatever it is, I want people to turn away. I want them to feel like not only are they seeing a real alien, but when we get in there, they're like, oh my God, that's unsettling to me. And that plays later in episode 3 for General Harding as well, and we get to sort of revisit that. But that was really the approach, and like, just, you know, have fun with it and
yeah.
work and that stuff. It was great. I can't tell you how many meetings and pictures I had to look at of alien heads to go, is this the alien head we
Carnage.
Want to represent of all alien kind? You know what I mean? Because everybody takes that very seriously.
Very seriously.
Very seriously.
What the representation is going to be is super important.
I think
important
you should have used Kazoo.
Kazoo.
Kazoo
it's
from the Flintstones.
Yeah.
I think it would have been. The audience
like
would have bought it.
Yeah,
they understood.
Yeah.
They've seen him already.
Green.
Season 3. It's going to be a new character. Kazoo's going to be. It's going to be great.
I love Kazoo.
Right?
It's great.
Flintstone. That would be so good.
Well, that leads to the end sequence where we get to watch the generals in private, watching that reel again. And it is a really chilling moment. Valentine in particular is sitting there and talks about put it in the vault with the rest of them. Tell me a little bit about how you guys wanted to play that moment, what you believed of your character in the moment as you were saying those words.
You know, I just kind of have to show up and work off this guy.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Not
easy.
It makes it easy for me. And what I mean by that is that in this particular instance, there was a vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
His guard was down, not intentionally, but because he was conflicted, and I knew it. You know, I have to do certain things and maintain a position, if you will. And sometimes that's going to differ from what Neil is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a through line of brotherhood that exists
mm-hmm.
that is just found in the military and found especially among those who have seen a lot of action and been involved in similar or the same projects over the years, war efforts. So that doesn't go away for me. Always a very strong through line for me, as well as maintaining this knowledge. You know, I think of this guy that I know back east. He does intelligence work. I had only talked to him over the phone, you know, and I had asked him about certain roles that I played. The first time I met him, it was by accident. I was going into a funeral. His head just popped through the door when I walked in, and he noticed me, and I noticed him, so he was unguarded. But in that moment, I remember sensing, I said, this guy not only has looked into the abyss, he's been in the abyss and he's come out. And now he's standing here giving me this smile. It was like a kaleidoscope of emotion that I experienced in this one moment with this man who had 30 years doing major cases. So there's a lot that goes down. Neil is on the field, right? And that's a whole thing in itself. He's a warrior.
Yeah.
And I know what that is because I've flown a lot of missions. And I'm sitting talking to people, researching, working moves, running operations, and it's a different thing. But there's a through line, and it's easy because we're becoming very good friends in real life, you know, brothers,
mm-hmm.
actually. So it's a very cool thing to be able to do that dance together where all these colors are playing themselves out. And then he's doubting me. you know, in his face. He's doubting me. And I got to just keep it, like, blank.
Because if you fall apart, the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah.
Because I'm falling apart. So if you don't stay the rock that you are, that's the truth of the characters, that my guy is falling apart because we're bringing up the stuff that I don't want to talk about anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
And he knows exactly what I'm going through. He's been there, too. We went to war together. We went through all these things. For him to be the rock in the situation that's so crucial to my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's funny. When I watch the show, I see Hynek and Quinn. Who are these guys? Isn't it the Valentine and Harding show?
Yeah.
No, literally.
No,
but
seriously,
but that's how it is. I'm like, these are our pawns that we're using, or we have to have on Hynek. I have to have this Hynek guy. We have to have this Hynek guy. Quinn's, you know, kind of our pawn or younger version of us. You know, he's our guy. But they're working for us. It's our show. And then when I see this show, I'm like, wait a minute, no, this is our show. You know, and it's funny because they're two totally different stories.
Yeah.
Both fantastic next to each other. Everyone in the show, from Susie to us to you name it, everyone's in conflict. That's what makes great television. This is a show about real human beings with different conflicts, and how are they going to deal with it?
The withholding of the execution of power when you have it, when you really have it, that's really something. That's a fine line to walk. Being on the field, you can kind of cut loose a little more mm-hmm. because you're on the field, you know. But, you know, you make one statement to somebody and you pull an operation that's a mistake. A lot of people could die.
A lot of mm-hmm. people could die, yeah.
The country could be in a mess.
People see things they don't need to see.
Yeah. But for both of us, you know,
mm-hmm.
that thing, he struggled and it was so great in terms of acting, what he was doing in terms of being. Withholding this, you know, great tension just takes somebody's head off.
Yeah.
That's just a very important thing.
Absolutely.
I just want to say, while these guys were talking, I have a pad and a pen here. Listening to you just now gave me an idea, and I wrote down it. I'm like, oh, I know.
That's the magic of writing right
for
there.
Next, I feel something for, you know, God willing, season 3.
Yes, I love it.
God willing and a creek don't shine.
Yeah.
You said season 7, didn't you?
Right, yeah. Well, it's 6 seasons in a movie.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
6 seasons in a movie. I love that.
Yes.
But the bones will bleach in the desert. That is one quote that will be stuck in my brain forever.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
Doing all the research as well, like, I don't know that I ever had a moment, and I don't think you can as a writer, certainly, when you're exploring characters, to go, oh, that was bad. You've just got to find the humanity in it. And by that, I don't mean the sympathy. I mean the humanity of what they do. And so the idea that if they were trying to protect, I've heard you both talk about this, but the idea of trying to protect national security, protect national interests, protect people, what could happen, not just in the country, but in the world at the time, and even now, I don't look at any of those people and think they could be evil. You have to take drastic measures at certain points, and I don't think as a writer you can afford to look at people and label them as something, because then you take away all of the interesting stuff that an actor can bring to a character.
You think of as being a father and mm-hmm. what you will do to protect yep. your children. Take that and become a person who is a high-ranking military official. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about hundreds of millions of children. So they have a job that is not what most people could do.
Right.
And they have to make really hard decisions. And sometimes those decisions have to be very quick decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to follow through because, as Michael said, people can die. Lots of bad things can happen. I couldn't imagine the stress it would be to be one of our characters at that time doing what they had to do just after the war. Now there's aliens. What the heck is going on?
Mm-hmm.
You two guys, go save the United States of America.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, boy.
And save Project Blue Book, because if it doesn't exist,
that's right.
You know, there's nothing there from your point of view to be a deterrent to general panic and things that could kill a lot of people. You know?
Sort of the mother of invention, of intelligence, is to be able to do things that are not seen. Because those things that are not seen, they're not going to be understood. Strong potential that not only will they not be understood, but they will be understood in a certain way that will cause vehemence and strong blowback. So it's a very powerful arena, that intelligence that we're both playing in.
Yeah, and brings it back to a binary level of, you know, letting us know why you guys are fighting so hard for it to exist. And even though Hynek and Quinn are questioning things from a more moral center or a quizzical center, it reiterates that fine line and balance between the two.
And that, I think there's like a central theme. It evolves with the storytelling. But when you approach just the overall idea about what we're trying to do from a show standpoint, this notion of is knowing the truth better or not? Are you helping or hurting people? And I think that is probably like a central question. Do you know what I mean? And I think you can face that in your own lives. Like everybody can understand the idea of like, we all know little truths we may not want to share with our partners or our loved ones or our family because we don't want to hurt them, you know, or they won't understand or we assume we know better. And there's plenty of psychology behind like truth is always the thing that's got to come out and the truth will always save us. I don't know what is right. And I think that is where really good drama comes from. You've heard the write what you know kind of thing. And I always say write what you want to know.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the answer is between knowing the truth and not. That's what allows us to write the stories every time, because there are moments when it makes sense and moments when it doesn't. I don't think there is an absolute truth to know. So, and that's where I think a lot of the good energy from the storytelling comes
from. Yeah, and I love that. So in every given episode, you can feel one way versus the other.
Exactly.
Which is the great balance of the show. Well, that brings us towards the end of this episode. So guys, thank you so much, Neil and Michael, for coming in and being able to be here in person and talk about your characters and, you know, definitely the very interesting changes and opening up of the two of them this season. And Sean, thank you for coming in and
always
helping us talk about how you charted the hows and the whys of this complicated story. As always, I just have to thank my podcasting team as well. Producer Kirby Dixon, producer-editor Paul Terry, our mixer and master, Dave Draper, and LA Digital Recording for hosting us. So if you out there in the ether are enjoying our show, please give us a review and subscribe on iTunes. Positive reviews help the profile of Project Blue Book and the podcast. We thank our listeners for listening. And with that, we leave you for another week to ponder the questions of the universe as we remind you, watch the skies.